This is the Lean Into Art Cast. Whether it's illustration, cartooning, UI design, or presenting, it all comes down to telling your story, communicating your ideas. It takes a lot of effort and curiosity, but let's lean into it.
One, two, and I believe, double check, we're recording on my end.
Recording here too.
All right. Okay. So you want to kick this one off since this is your episode, Rob?
Sure. But we don't have to. Do we have to jump into it right away? We had so much pre-show talk. I guess I am warmed up, ready to go. Jersey Drozd, comicsaregreat.com.
Comicsaregreat.com. Soon to be sugarycereals.com. Excited about that. Hey, I got a question for you. I want your opinion, and I'll ask this publicly because then other people can chime in if they feel like it. Cool. 1024 by 768 for a comics page, is that too big for a website?
Absolutely not. I mean, one way to look to deal with that is to look at your Google stats, but of your current sites or what have you. I mean, because you mentioned Sugary Cereals, that's been around a long time. Actually, it's a relaunch, right?
The relaunch, and actually all the archives are down right now. Right now there's very, very little content on the site. There were over 300 pages on there before of comics material, but I got to re-upload everything. I got to repost everything. And one of the problems I'm running into is I want the new format is going to be iPad ready. You know, it's going to be the exact resolution of so that I can just export it as a PDF and then you have a great reading experience on the iPad. But that raises the question of should it be iPad native resolution on the website as well, or should I go with something smaller? Because now if I take all these older pages that are taller than 1024 by 768 and I make them 1024 pixels wide, now we got a mammoth page that there's no way you're going to see the thing before the scroll. It's going to be, you're looking at a third of the page before, you know, like upon page launch. And I was looking at the site on my 15-inch laptop with a slightly lower resolution. It's an older laptop. And it doesn't quite fit. I have to do the thing where you command minus, zoom out a little bit on the website in order to see it.
Yep.
And so it got me wondering if maybe I should go down to 960.
Yeah, that's exactly that is the safe middle ground that hits a wide variety of machines. Well, I think web designers in the audience are going to be itching about the word responsive design, right? Are you familiar with this?
No, term? Please.
So, let's see what you're going through is something that's been a challenge forever. It's like, well, what resolution do you target, right? You build something in pixels. It's got to be in a pixel grid of, you know, X number by Y number. And, you know, devices that are a lot smaller than X number or Y number end up doing extra scrolling vertically and horizontally. Mm-hmm. It's just, that's been the way it is. Well, there is such a huge influx of mobile devices. It's become like this natural force in the environment to cause like new thinking about design. And one way to manage that, and in general, I mean, like I think there's so many awesome things going on with, you know, the HTML5 family of technologies. So like the standards are moving along, the adoption, and then the culture too is trying to tackle these things. And so responsive design has come, is one of these things that's grown out of those three forces that can deal with different widths in each in its own optimized manner. So in the older CSS, you had media queries, right, where you could try to load a different CSS. So you could say, you know, if it's mobile or if it's a screen. I mean, there's basically browsers could have a media query, you know, supported CSS tag, right? Okay. Then you get some flexibility with that. But then what's happened now is browsers support a greater level of querying. So now you can do Hey, if it's above 700 pixels, load this. If it's below, load that. As far as a CSS, and possibly even use things like, well, you could query it in JavaScript too to also have sort of three scenarios that you'd support. Well, it ends up being three to five. It depends on what you want to do, because you have your phone at portrait, your phone at landscape, your tablet at portrait, your tablet at landscape, and then you have your desktop, which could be you know, laptop-ish in resolution, or really huge.
Yeah.
So theoretically, you could have a handful of different resolutions and some code that sort of adjusts your divs to fill or shrink and realign themselves. So maybe in the super wide screen, maybe you have a big comic on the left and then the extra blog detail or whatever is on the right. And so people with this vast, luxurious monitor, you could handle them in a special case, just as you could stack and shrink on someone looking at it in portrait on their iPhone.
So I just need to monkey with some more, the different CSS templates, create like different templates for the different browsing experiences.
Google searching for responsive design and you'll be well set. And you'll find some JavaScript libraries that'll help you, like what, Fit Text will help you shrink or enlarge the header text for your posts. So that could be kind of automatically managed, and you can, let's see, I'm forgetting, as far as you can do some for images too, so that you could automatically resize that image to fit a given width and height, or to have new scroll behavior based on what you feel is optimal for a given device.
So then if I ever do figure out how to do that, that navigation scheme where there would be hover buttons on either side of the comic page, I can have that load up in a special CSS file that is just for the tablet experience, where the CSS for the web comic site for the tablet experience would be, it would just load up essentially just the comic page, no blog, no nothing else. And then here's like the share buttons and here's the navigation buttons, just like how I wanted. It would essentially be like a mobile version of the site.
Yeah.
Oh God. I gotta work hard on this. I only got a month before I wanted to launch this thing. I have to gambare, as they say. Do my best.
Okay.
Have you ever heard that?
No.
One of my students introduced me to this. It's a Japanese word that gets passed around a lot. That means it's interchangeable with do your best and go for it. So it's like it's like the fist pump in the air, kind of the shout word that you do, like when you're wishing somebody well, like they're going off to school, you gambare, do your best, or like gambare, let's go for it, let's do it.
Sweet. I can use a word like that,
or lean into it for that matter. That's Japanese for lean into it. Listen to your Uncle Jerry's, he knows. Well, thanks for that tip. Responsive design. Sure. I'll Google it later and I will spend ungodly amount of hours making even more CSS files. So
one more thing to look up is responsive design plus feature detection as opposed to browser detection. So
feature detection.
So stuff like modernizer.js. Which is misspelled at, Web 2.0 style. Modernize, and then, there isn't a, it's ZR or something.
Not ZER. Oh, cool.
Yeah. Which it is an awesome library, but,
I used to sign my emails back in the early 2000s, just -JRZ, Jersey, right?
Cool.
I wonder if I should just go. I should just make that my name from now on. Just take out the E Y. Take out all the vowels. J R Z. That also looks like Jers. Anyway, so we're talking about design.
Yeah.
And I feel like I have to do an exquisite job of the Sugary Cereals redesign because I know it's going to be looked upon from on high by Mr. Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com.
I had to downgrade my high horse because it hurts when I fall off it. Now it's quite low. It's more of a like an under a automobile like wheel jack thing. So it's not that high.
Oh, well, I'm gonna worry anyway. So you care a lot about this design stuff.
Yeah, I do. I was just thinking. I'm curious. Like, what are your thoughts about looking at the discipline of design and how it's funny how it can, because it's not something like tangible, like plumbing or carpentry or, and I would argue those disciplines end up dealing with design as well, because maybe stepping back, my rough discipline would be, I suppose, what, organizing your thoughts to help you solve a problem in a way you would expect. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's so, a kind of design, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people go through those same kinds of things, but then sometimes you end up forming, you could have a one-on-one arrangement where maybe you're the whole team serving a client, or you could be one person in a team serving in a design capacity, where whether that could be visual design, information design, user experience design.
Yeah, it sounds like we're in right now we're trying to define what we mean by design.
Yeah.
So I'm going to dictionary.com. Okay. Because, let's see. Oh, I didn't know they do these embedded ads on there. Design School Online. Build your brand. Design, to prepare the preliminary sketch or the plans for a work to be executed, especially to plan the form and structure of, to design a new bridge, or to plan and fashion artistically or skillfully. Aha! Look at this. Artistically or skillfully. That's where we cover like plumbing. And although I'm sure there are plumbers out there who there's like an art to what they do as well, right?
Exactly.
How do I arrange the conduits and pipes in this place so as to be nearly invisible even when the walls are or the ceilings are exposed?
Right. Which would be the opposite of a plumbing contractor that I had come in estimate when we were working on our upstairs attic. They were like, yeah, we'll just bring those pipes right through the kitchen. Like, foot or two away from the wall, straight down the middle. Maybe we'll make a pillar out of it.
Right. Right. I looked when I was house hunting years ago, we looked at a converted cottage, which was right backed to a forest preserve. Talk about awesome. And it like you get there and it's like living on Endor, right? It's like I just go in my backyard and it's just like, oh, where are the Ewoks? Oh, there they are. But the kitchen, he did the water piping in the kitchen so that it was like very, very tiny PVC pipe that just ran right across and underneath the picture window, like right on the walls. It was on the walls and like going down to like the faucet. Like, wow, why did he open up the wall? Just pull the paneling off or pull the, really? But anyway.
It's like living in an aquarium.
It's like, you don't think of like going into your kitchen and seeing the plumbing sticking out of the walls, right?
No.
Anyway. So, I'm going to throw this out and see what you think of it. By design, do we mean artificially recombining elements or ideas to either execute something, to make something functional, or to communicate an idea, to be something that even communicating an idea is a function, right? So like to make you feel something or understand something. But understanding that a person is involved in this. This is an artificial reconstruction of something. And the goal a lot of times is for it to feel absolutely natural, so it communicates the maximum amount of idea with the minimal amount of materials.
Mm-hmm. I think you're baking in design principles into design with that thought. But so you have because you have the design itself, but then you have the how do you go about it and why, and all of a sudden you have the sort of the experiences of a designer and sort of the practices of a design industry that are now you can take advantage of because they're sort of like well-tested extra capabilities beyond the core idea of design.
Why are you so mad about it? We get this.
Well, I let's see. could be just me, but I think as designers, I think a lot of people who would listen to this podcast probably have some aspect of design that they you know, enjoy and utilize pretty often. And maybe you're like really, you know, already been there, done that with thinking about design, which is cool. But I think we've run into challenges with, you know, I want to wonder how can we communicate design and the value of it to make it more tangible? Because oftentimes, I mean, your understanding of design it, as it serves you, that's awesome. But if you're going into a project that is beyond you as an individual, how do you make that work as a role or as a service to make it clear that, well, could I invent an anecdote on the spot? So let's say you present something, I'm presenting something to a client and I get some feedback saying, well, I don't like this there. Let's move it. Let's move that, that navigation element to the footer.
Yeah.
I don't like it. It's in the way of that cool logo thing. Like I spent a lot of money, you know, I had another design firm in here to design that logo. That's gotta be huge. In fact, make it 80% bigger.
Yep. Yep.
And now all sorts of other design elements are affected. Maybe you've never been in this situation, but I kind of guess you have. And so then I would argue maybe having more of a, you know, a set of, you know, attributes and benefits of design that we could easily
I think what you're pointing at too is something I run into every once in a while, and especially with, I don't want to turn this into like a class war between Apple users and non-Apple users, okay? But one, you know, I really don't. I mean, I've got my eye on Android. I'm watching what's going on with it. Going like the moment you achieve X, Y, and Z on my list of things I really want out of a software environment, I'll happily break up with Apple. You know, I'm very, I'm not very loyal in that respect. I just want what works well for me. And anyway, but you know, like a lot of people, like a lot of Apple bashers that I've known in the past, they rail against Apple as being too much design that ultimately doesn't serve a purpose. They justify their choices by saying, I'm utilitarian. I don't need it to look beautiful. I just need it to work for me and work really well. And all of this swooshing and liquid stuff, that's just them bamboozling stupid people into taking their less than functional environment. To which I would say, no, what I've experienced is that it's very intuitive. And I had an experience messing around with an Android phone recently where I did not know how to delete an application. It was not immediately apparent to me. Whereas most functionality in the iOS environment is immediately apparent to you. Why? Because of design. So where I'm going with this analogy here, and now I just made a whole bunch of Android users really angry. But to be fair, it was an older Android version. It was like pre-Honeycomb or something.
It's not your Android.
It's not your Android.
I'm not talking about your Android.
Your Android is good. I was messing with somebody's really old, junky Android version. but where I'm going is that design sometimes in some people's minds gets classified as make it pretty. That's design. But design also has to be functional, right? It's both beautiful and functional at the same time. It has to be usable, especially when you're dealing with something like a website or, heck, even your comic. You can make a beautiful comics page that doesn't communicate. This is a case I make in all of my workshops. You can be the most brilliant illustrator of all time, but if you can't communicate ideas, if you don't know how to assemble using shape, size, and line, how to assemble these elements to communicate the maximum amount of ideas, then you're not a storyteller. And comics need storytellers more than it needs beautiful illustrators. So I think that whenever I talk with people about this kind of subject, go ahead.
Can I put a little flag onto that or whatever, or a little addendum? I would say that design and storytelling have a lot in common because you're addressing the intentional flow of you mean, information.
You mean like your workshop, storytelling to make your comics UI awesome, which is for sale
no,
in the
Leotard. My secret sauce is all over the place. What do I do?
I was just putting the big red button on it so people could hit purchase now.
No, I'm kidding.
$25, folks. It's a great presentation. You really should. Anybody who is serious about this design stuff should pay attention to it. But anyway, go ahead.
No, thanks. I'd love to point out how design and storytelling are very, very interrelated in how you're purposefully ordering and structuring the information to convey some experience to make it more likely to, you put something in your story to try to cause a laugh. You're going to use different techniques than if you wanted to make someone cry or if you wanted to make someone just, get curious about the next thing in a mystery or something. Anyway, mm-hmm. there's so much, intentional authoring going on in both cases.
No, I've run into this situation that you've described in different ways where I'm working with other people on a team and there's the person on the team who's like, look, let's just set it up as a blog. Let's just set it up as a blog and go. And to which I say, well, but the users we're trying to reach with this thing aren't necessarily going for a blog first and foremost. We have to sit down and define who our users are. We got to figure out who's going to be using this and how they're going to be using it, and what information they're going to be looking for. And on one of these projects, I specifically challenged you, Rob. I put the website in front of me. I said, show me where to find the videos. Where do you find videos on this thing? And you were like, I don't know. And I'm like, yeah, it's not immediately apparent. Mm. I'm trying to drive this in a direction by saying, like, this is what I'm struggling with the sugary cereals thing too, is that I know who I want to read this and on what platforms I want them to read it on, or I'm trying to accommodate for as many platforms as possible. I'm anticipating the fact that not many people are going to read it on the website. Most people are going to read it on mobile devices. So I need a website that can easily recombobulate itself to look great on all platforms. So it's not, I tested out the current design on the iPad and it's kind of, you know, I double tap on the image to like make it fill the page. But then every time I hit the navigation button to go to the next page, it zooms back out, and oh, that's so aggravating. I just want to see the comic. Get all that other crap out of the way. So, yeah, it's like it's sort of you have to anticipate the needs of your users, just as you have to, in a way, anticipate who you want to read the thing, right? It's like I tell my students, like, okay, imagine your target audience. Now, you shouldn't write to your target audience, although that can be a fun limitation to put upon yourself. But you say, you imagine who's the person you could spend a weekend in a cabin with and not want to choke them. You know, that's the person you're writing for. Write for that person, and that'll give you like sort of a direction to head in and whatever. But so too, you have to kind of do something similar when you're designing, right? And I guess in what you were the anecdote you were talking about is this was a case where a client really wasn't thinking about the user; they were just thinking about, I just like this to look nice.
Exactly, and I would say that in those situations. Maybe it's unclear to a person seeking those changes. What change would affect, you know, design principles? Like because obviously someone wouldn't want to, you know, change the design and have a negative result, because the whole point of involving that discipline is to say, well, we have we have expressed some kind of goal and audience and whatnot. And well, the design will help us reach that. So obviously, the client wouldn't want to put that in jeopardy. But then, how would they discern if they are using design principles or heuristics based on their experience or opinion? And if you've never really considered the difference between those three things, then maybe they all seem like they're the same.
Well, let's define them then. What do you mean when you say those three different things? Opinion, heuristics, and applying design principles.
So I think the principles, and you could say the phrase best practices and whatnot. You could say the fashion, right? So there's a zeitgeist of pretty much, well, probably any currently practiced art form. There's something cool going on, and if it's being called cool, there's enough people to observe it, whatever, and they're kind of elevating it and voting on it and whatever. So those things, and so there's probably extra. There's more than just the three, maybe, because maybe fashion is an extra one. But I think those things end up becoming principles that we tell each other as a story as we go about this discipline. Watch out for that trap. Here's a way around it. We let's see. So certain certain landmark papers. Oh boy, I can't believe I'm going to misquote the title of it, but it's roughly called Seven Things Plus or Minus Two. And I think it was about human cognition and how many things people keep track of. And it's been used heavily in the area of you know, human computer interface when you're trying to design things that, and I should be able to quote the gentleman's name and all that. I apologize.
It'll be in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll look it up for the show notes and whatnot. But it's an example of something that someone had a theory. They put it out. Their peers reviewed it and they said, "Wow, that really holds water." And let's go ahead and let's use that as a measure on our designs to see. Okay, how many elements do we have? 10 or 11? We have, you know. Now we're crossing a threshold here based on this best practice. Is it worth crossing this threshold? I don't know. You know, let's come up with why we're doing it and let's work that through. And so those design principles aren't there as a trap to make us all robotically follow the same thing, but they give us a vocabulary to tackle ambiguity, wrestle it to the ground.
Oh gosh, let's here I come in as the storyteller translator. Mm-hmm. Limitations breed creativity. You know, if I say to you, "Tell me a story," and you go but if I say, "Tell me a story about your seventh birthday party," or "Tell me a story about your high school graduation," "Tell me a story about your first job interview," suddenly you got a place to start to tell me a story by giving you that limitation. You know, the Haight-Ashbury resident is going to say to me, "Hey man, quit trying to put me in a box." But the storyteller is going to say, "Okay, that's interesting. Where can I go from there?" So these best practices may sound like an arbitrary set of limitations, which is kind of what they are. They're proven, they're theoretical, and they people are testing them and they seem to work. But you know, they're not a hard and fast rule. It's not some edict from on high on a stone tablet. But it gives you a starting point. So when you're sitting there staring at a blank canvas of HTML, your blank text editor or whatever, you know, it's like, all right, what do I do? Webcomic, how am I going to do this thing? You know?
Yeah. And yeah, it's obviously the interactive space, obviously you mentioned the storytelling to make your comic UI awesome. And I mean, essentially that is UI design 101 mixed with storytelling and a little beyond. It's sort of like, here's a little bit of UI design 200 or 300 mixed in and a couple little, you know, ninja tricks here and there. Because you could express all these concerns, these goals that you have, and you try to, you know, make something appear. So you have your screen and it's this visual real estate. You need to divide it up and fill it somehow. Well, you're going to fill it based on things that are going to help you accomplish the reason you're putting it out there in the first place. And there are, you can go through a design process to express these things and then refine them to decide how they should look and how do they relate to one another and how do the, you know, how do the user's interactions cause them to change over time and stuff. And that can really sound like stepping out of this, you know, throwing that hat aside and I've played that role a lot, but then I've also observed a lot how in presenting designs, they aren't always observed as, well, oh yeah, I mean, I don't know. You guys just saw what Amazon was doing and you did that, right? And so, well, Amazon's just, someone made that up and I'm funding this, so I'll make this up, right?
Yeah.
And these conversations that are very, you know, very challenging to navigate. Very familiar, but so how do we perspective that, well, okay, the principles versus heuristics. Okay, let's nail the other two real quick. So what we just talked about is opinion. It's just, it's gut feeling. It could be informed by your, you know, tapping into the greater conscious mind of all designers on the planet that have ever existed. Or it could be that you like yellow and In either case, your answer as far as why you did it is probably going to be, I like yellow.
Yeah.
Or yellow's cool, or because it's cool.
Which we, you know, I don't want to undervalue that either, as I'm sure you don't. You know, it's like that can have a value because that can add a idiosyncratic feel to a design that otherwise would not be there. If you were just slavishly applying yourself to design principles and heuristics and didn't bring your opinion into it, you missed the opportunity of putting this really unique stamp on it that sometimes a little flourish of a just because can make all the difference, right? Operating from your gut sometimes. Sometimes it's just putting on that little visor while you're in the Death Star trench, or taking the visor off and just following your gut because the old man told you to.
Or, you know, if the old man is just a, you know, your own gut saying, you know what, I'm the Force and I'm just going to do it. And I'm doing it because I believe I can, and that's, this is an expression of my existence. Bam.
Yeah. Yeah. This is an expression of the world as I see it. Yeah.
So nothing wrong with that.
But we have to recognize it for what it is, too, right?
Yeah, it's interesting that designs that, this is kind of a side thing that's interesting, that designs that lack a sort of tight author perspective and voice, they tend to reek of compromise and a new kind of ambiguity, where maybe the tasks are represented, but there's no spark. There's no it's easy to sort of wring all the air out of a design by overly forcing principles at it. And it's like a more I'm trying to think of a tangible example without like picking on apps too much. I suppose we already talked about the difference between Apple and Android.
Yeah.
But, or we could talk about the difference between desktop environments with, you know, iOS and Windows and like Ubuntu, right? Okay. Probably over time, final judgment or whatever. But if you look a few years back in Ubuntu, I mean, what they had the GNOME desktop and they're working on finding their voice as far as what fits, what shouldn't be. They're making their trade-offs as far as honing that experience versus, you know, Mac OS X, who, you know, Apple is populated and has a lot of design in its business model, right? So there's a lot of designers there, and there's a lot of really skilled designers that that do affect the results that Apple puts out, and that's been that way for a long time. So their experience does have that, has some kind of strong feel to its experience, right? So using it, you're interacting with these like invisible forces that are the design expressions of the ideas of these teams of people that are working together pretty darn tightly, right? Mm-hmm. Versus more loosely on Windows, where a little bit more, right? They've got their R&D department, they set up patterns, and they work toward having consistent results, and but it's a little bit looser. There's like different core forces and assumptions they have versus Ubuntu, who is like, it's far more open. But what's interesting, you look at them over time and not just one snapshot. So Ubuntu had a little more of a little more looseness, a little more bumps and inconsistencies as far as how do icons look versus, you know, how many menu items, you know, could serve this given purpose? How are they categorized and organized? It's wild, like looking at the current Ubuntu. I mean, it's really, you know, become very refined. So this is where I'm landing on a, you know, this isn't a, you know, final judgment right or wrong, but a lot of times let's see. And those are probably all bad examples to compare like your average design effort against, because all of them are bringing to bear such great resources to try to tackle these problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as in the amount and as in the skill and all that kind of stuff. So they have different cultures, they have different results, but...
And you're also speaking from the standpoint of a freelance designer, somebody who works on a contractual basis with different clients. So you're always working with different teams, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners who have done any kind of work in a freelance capacity, you know, going back to play the translator again, the story I've told many times is when I was doing that freelance illustration assignment, and this team of clients, it was like a committee, kept saying, make him 10% happier, make the character 10% happier. And after 12 rounds of this, I had a character designed who was so terrifyingly cheerful that it's the first drawing I ever did that actually frightens me. I drew something that I am frightened to look at because it just looks disturbing. But they themselves didn't realize what they were doing because there were so many cooks in the kitchen and they didn't know what they were trying to achieve. They just had this gut instinct, this opinion that he needs to be happier because kids like happy, you know?
Yeah. And it's the, so there, that's more like what I would say most design projects, you know, have to work through is that, well, design is important enough to address as a skill and is being brought, you know, to help solve this problem. But then it's not quite to the extent of like, well, Ubuntu or Windows or, you know, Mac OS X, in that there's other weighted factors that are affecting the result more. And oftentimes... Yeah. A large group of them represented as different departments and people from, you know, different backgrounds and caring about different things and not caring about the same things and all that.
Well, that's where I want to get it. Like you're talking about, like, how do we communicate this to clients or to people who listen to this show? How do we make this like more clear to them why this is important? One of the problems that I run into in freelance illustration, maybe I shouldn't say problem, because I totally get where these people are coming from. Okay. Look at the standpoint of the client. You just hired on a person to do this magical creative thing that you don't know how to do on your own, right? And you understandably would become exalted by this. It's like, oh my gosh, I get to, like, you know, when I got hired to do this one comic, which I chronicled in the Thunder Punch Daily podcast, I got hired to do this comic where they wanted me to come up with a fleet of brand new characters, a superhero universe for their school district. And, you know, and when they told me what they wanted, I was like, oh man, can I do that or can I do that? Yeah, that's a gimme. I've been practicing all my life to do a project like this. Mm-hmm. And the committee, justifiably, was very excited about the concept of we get to co-design our own superhero universe. How cool is that? And like a lot of these people are my age. They grew up on Super Friends, He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. They knew where I was coming from in terms of like when I brought in my examples of what I can do. But I noticed that they kind of shut down the moment, whenever I had a meeting with them, they would kind of glaze over the moment I started talking about the design principles of constructing such a story. Whenever I would talk about, well, you need, like they said, like, well, we want it to be about this character. They had a pre-designed character that they wanted me to build something around. And I said, well, that character's all well and good, but he's just one character. I said, you know what really works is like if you work out teams, you have a good team and a bad team. And then the more characters you have, the more opportunities you have for kids to map on their, try out their options and personalities. And because like a kid's story, a kid's superhero story is really about dress rehearsal for adulthood. And all the characters should represent the different options of adulthood that a kid can be confronted with so they can identify early on with where they want to go. I start going into this, and this is the stuff that fascinates me as a cartoonist. Mm-hmm. They're all falling asleep. They're like, yeah, whatever, professor. Just make some characters for us to approve or deny. And they weren't mean about it, but there was that kind of like, okay, yeah. Well, sure, yeah. How about you get to work, huh? And so then I turned in the designs. And then the famous example I love to talk about is Dame Lady Cat, who was a house cat who dresses like Mary Poppins, who happens to be a ninja. Again, now, anybody with kids, anybody with like who has ever been around eight-year-olds would know that this is a character constructed to make an eight-year-old boy or girl go crazy with you know, enthusiasm. A house cat that can kick people in the face and she's all dainty with her umbrella and everything, that's funny. That's really funny. And the committee says, you know, kids can't identify with talking animal characters. Really, second graders, they just don't identify. And I went, whoa, really? My Little Pony, Care Bear, Charlotte's Web, Babe the Pig. I brought all these examples. Had they listened to me when I was doing going into my design principle mojo, they would have understood that. But because that stuff is boring and the, hey, professor, shut up, just make the thing, it created this obstacle where I had to defend my character. And I was ready just to take her back and say, I'll do a story about her myself. I don't need to give you this. But then I thought, no, you know, I'm going to make a stand on this. These kids, they deserve to have good characters, and I'm not going to let this committee water this stuff down, knowingly or not, right? And so I had to bring up all these like examples to defend my case for this character. And even then they were like, I don't know. I guess we'll see. But, you know, you seem to feel strongly about this, so we'll just go with it. But I didn't convince him.
And in the end, it was more of a, well, we still want to work with Jersey. And boy, this seems like it's kind of a deal breaker, I guess. And so it, I would say a lot of design discussions that where not all parties were in quite alignment.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're doing that kind of discussion. I think, let's see, I don't know how to put it. It is kind of a debate or an argument where there's a perspective that you really are attached to being the official direction. And it's a bit of a win and lose at that point.
Yep.
And oftentimes, like the win has come from like, yeah, I've done a passionate, you know, explanation and trying to tie into, you know, detailed examples of well, hopefully, you know, heuristics based on my experience and based on, other examples in the industry. So things like arguing for, so if a client has a heavy duty visual style as a part of their brand that really fits no user interface controls, right? And they're like, well, we need this to be, you know, our buttons are really sort of spinner things and whatever, and it fits. And that's like, well, that's part of their world and that's part of their interactive voice, but yet there's no platform that really backs that up. There's this next thing in order, you know, like that there's sort of a glue in between, like you need to build your own like library of components then to make that work. Otherwise you'll be butting up against this for every single project you try to do. You'll be redoing it. Possibly. And so if you basically decide that it's like deciding that, well, you need your house to be solar powered one day. It's sort of a fundamental assumption that your house is, if it's like the platform you're trying to build off of. Well, now you have a very disruptive change in there and a very different assumption that it was designed for this thing and you want to use it for something else. And now you'll have to make these something in the middle that, mm-hmm. that can make affordances and adapt it to that new purpose. And so that's, but you know, a lot of times this extra thing, it isn't the, you know, hey professor, be quiet and build the thing, or, you know, go back to the team to build the thing or whatever. It's the, that's a new thing I got to build, man. That's more money. That's another, you know, wow. How much more time is that going to be, right? How many more, and who else do we need to get in here to work on that? I mean, do we have people that can do that? And mm-hmm. and all of a sudden it's a new, you know, new conversation, new way, new thing to justify. And obviously, and sometimes the only way to win is to, you know, I don't even view those as wins.
No.
when a client goes along with something because they're like, well, okay, I can see you care a lot about that.
Well, to put a happy note on the end of that story, I actually got to do a series of school visits delivering those books to the kids they were intended for. And mm-hmm. the client was with me. And when we introduced the characters and I said, this is Dame Lady Cat, who is a house cat who dresses like Mary Poppins and she loves manners, but she's also a ninja and she can totally kick big characters' butts. Every time I got a roar of laughter from the kids. So the client was witness to the fact that I was right. And now when we proceed in any future projects, I'm going to have a little bit more weight in that room. Not that I want to exercise muscle, but that when I say this is a good idea, they're probably going to have more faith in me, you know? And that happened with the other projects in the past. Whenever I worked on a long-term project, it would start out with all of these arguments at the outset where people would say, oh, we want you to color this in a marker style because that's how comics are colored. And I thought, really, you're telling me how comics are colored? Oh, interesting. Okay. And they're colored with markers, you say. Wow. You know, and so it would turn into a fight and a debate. And then I'd have to show them all these examples, like show me where the markers were used here. You know, and eventually they would take more stock in my opinions and give me less input to say, we need a storyboard about such and such. We know you how you do it, so you can handle it. But anyway, where I was going with this is part of the dynamic in working with a team too is the whole ego of wanting, man, something funny happens to grownups where they want so badly to defend their realm of expertise and they don't like an outsider coming in. And whereas when somebody presents me with an idea that I'm not familiar with, I'll be like, what? What's that? Really? Oh, let me hear about it. You know, not to say like, oh, I'm a good goody and everybody else is evil about this. But you know, it's like we talk a lot about people who, the difference between people who like to learn and people who are frightened of learning, you know, and people who are frightened of learning tend to be people who like to draw a little circle around their realm of expertise. Don't challenge it. I'm the expert on this. Hey, shut up, professor, and just draw. I'm not here to learn something today. Whereas what I was excited about when I engaged in that project was, wow, cool. I get to put all of my theories about children's entertainment to the test. And I've got a group of experts. These are all people who work in the educational system and they can work with me and I'll learn from them. They'll learn from me. This is going to be great. And it turned into this battle of wills in some cases where, you know, well, we know what children like. You're just the artist. Just draw for us on this. Not everybody was like that, you know, but that kind of thing can happen when you're confronted with people on a team who just are, they just want to get through the thing, right? Or they're just excited about having this magical creative person doing things for them and they just want the person just to create the magic and they don't want to have to learn how to articulate what it is that they're trying to achieve with the thing.
Exactly, because it can feel, because even if you do like to learn, some people don't like to learn in a very explicit manner, right? It's more of the, oh, okay, wow, cool. Yesterday I noticed that new thing worked, and now I'm going to keep doing that new thing.
Yeah.
And that's cool. Everyone has different styles, and I think obviously when you're designing solutions for people, you end up needing to somehow be pretty adaptive to a lot of different styles of learning. And maybe some of it's the hunches, some observations, heuristics of my own as far as the like what helps us get outside of the sort of I don't know what to call it, the baloney realm where they have their opinion, you have your theoretically really informed, tested opinion that becomes your heuristics, your toolkit, and your design biases that you're using to solve problems that you feel that you're on a professional path where you're becoming more and more effective at it, and you have some evidence to back that up. They may not be observing that.
Right.
So calling that the baloney realm, because there no one can tell the difference from what is substantial and not made of baloney and what's made of baloney. It's all, which is kind of a meta problem I have as far as the debate, as far as perception, reality.
Yeah.
Tag that one. I don't know. Cause, let's see. So when you're stuck there, one way to resolve that I've noticed that people have used in the realm of, user experience design is, like what you just described, your classroom visit. Having video of that.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times projects, you know, someone, you know, running the show was really busy doing other things and they're not able to, you know, visit the installation of some software or a user seeing it happen or the delivery of the book that was written for their big project because they're off negotiating the next thing, whatever. Well, video of real people really interacting, really seeing and really experiencing that. My hunch is our sort of hardwired empathy and ability to perceive via story and whatnot. I think that is what makes those capture little a video file of someone using something can blow away like an hour long presentation that like you could theoretically to an audience that were invested and cared about it, you would be doing a lot of fun teaching and collaborative work, right? And you would be learning too. But if they're not invested and they don't care about that same domain like you do, they're not going to get that out of it. What they would get out of like a 1 to 5 minute video.
Yeah.
Of someone just picking up the book and laughing or, you know, clicking on a few buttons in an app and going, wow, or, hey, wait a minute. And then all of a sudden talking out loud or experiencing the trouble, because the empathy works there too, where users like, what, wait, it crashed on me, or wait, it, you know.
Yeah. I don't know where to click.
Where
yeah.
do I just put that thing in there and it just disappeared. And, you know, someone as a stakeholder now sees a real person going through that. And all of a sudden it's like, wow, I got to help.
Yeah. Documenting.
And making it like a little, but it blows away any other, you know, like, you know, a design document, right? You can put some well laid out.
It plays much more to the lizard brain than, say, a spreadsheet of your Google Analytics.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
It's like, look, we got
this resolution.
We got this kind of bounce rate. Oh, wow. Good for you. You know, but here's a 1 minute video of a kid just being delighted. Like, you know, it's like I took the Sugary Cereals, one of the collections, to a show a couple years ago. And this little boy picked up the book and started reading the whole book. And the mom's like, come on. I want to go to another table. He's like, hold on. He was like, you know, he did that thing that you do when you're really watching a TV show that you love and somebody's interrupting you. Shut up. I'm watching this, you know? And then the mom's like, oh, whatever. And she just leaves. The kid sits down on the floor in front of the table. And then he puts the book back at the table and he looks me dead. And this is like an 8-year-old. And he looks me dead in the eyes like, that was awesome. And that's the thing where it's like, oh, if only I could have captured that right then and there, because that's the thing I could show to a client to say, this is what I can do for you. You know, here's a kid right. who could not be parted from this book. And yeah, he didn't buy it, but he was lost in it and he read it cover to cover, and even letting his mom go someplace else, leaving him mm-hmm. alone, you know? That's the kind of.
It speaks volumes, and it's that's the trick, is somehow to sort of instigate those events and capture them.
Yeah.
You know, to whatever end, obviously, if you're being, you know, if you're being sincere about the design would mean, even if it worked out, if it went down in flames, mm-hmm. right? That, yeah. If the kid picked up the book and, I don't know, just had a lot more negative reaction to it.
Yeah.
Right. That would be something to capture as well. I mean,
what I would capture then is when the adults look at the book and go, what's this? And then they flip through it and like, oh, it's kid stuff. And they throw it down. and I would say,
there you go.
You know, it's like, well, I'm clearly not reaching that market. I am clearly not, you know, adults who don't like children's entertainment. Now, adults who either had kids or really think fondly of their childhood experiences, they would respond to it. But any adult who is like that kind of, you know, I don't like baby stuff. I don't watch musicals. That kind of adult had a very negative reaction to it. I mean, at Wizard World Chicago, it was outright disdain. It was unmasked disdain for what I was doing, which was kind of rough to deal with.
Jeez.
But you know, another thing, what we're getting at here too is, I think there's a lot of psychology that has to come into play. I think probably a lot of cartoonists and designers and storytellers would do well to take a few psychology classes, because I'm reminded of, I just finished listening to an audiobook by Dan Gilveson, who was the voice actor who played Bumblebee. He wrote a audiobook about his experience playing Bumblebee. It's a very short book. It's 80 minutes long. It's like $2 on iTunes. And one of the things he says at the close of the book is, like, he answers the question, would I ever play Bumblebee again, given the chance? He's like, you bet. And he's like, but I haven't been given the chance. And he's like, and I don't know why, but here's some theories as to why. And one of the things he puts forth is that every time the Transformers franchise changes hands, the producers, he says, like, producers don't have a lot to do except like watch spreadsheets and make sure the money's getting spent right and maintain schedules. So they like to get involved and put their stamp on the thing. This is the Michael Bay Transformers. This is the Cartoon Network Transformers. This is the so-and-so. So, you know, it's like, and because of that, he suspects that they intentionally are not going back to the original voice actors, designs, and whatever, because they want to say, like, this is my way of doing it, which is understandable. It's a perfectly human way. If you know your psychology, you know that this is not a monstrous attitude. This is a perfectly natural attitude. And so, and consequently, Gilveson is very forgiving of the thing. And he said, but unfortunately, you know, this also means that it has the tendency to make people forget what made the thing work in the first place. Putting your stamp can sometimes make you lose sight of what is the thing, whether it's a show or an app or a comic or a user interface, what is it supposed to do? What was its original function? And you can iterate on that, and you can iterate on that, but the moment you over iterate in the effort to stamp your brand on it, like this is a Spike Lee joint, you know, then you run the potential of losing the core functionality of what the thing was. Or am I just being nostalgic? I just want my old Bumblebee back.
That's funny. No, I would say we could just end the podcast right there. I mean, that's a good bow on the whole topic. And I do think it's a pretty deep one. We're speaking to different groups of people that have a wide set of valid human needs, and that they are bringing you in to help them probably serve someone else who also has their valid set of human needs. And so psychology comes into play, discipline, communication, and then figuring out how do you present your ideas of design in general to that audience that you're serving, and how does it get incorporated into the product that you're assisting with.
And going back to the psychology thing even a little bit more, I noticed that just as like in different social contexts, we behave differently, right? You talk differently to your wife when you're alone with her than you do when you're with your wife in a restaurant versus when you're with your wife at a party, and so on. Our behaviors understandably change depending on the context of the environment that we're in. So too, I noticed with client meetings, depending on the client, I had clients who would contact me and go, "Yo, dude, can you make it happen? I knew that you could. Thanks, bro." You know, and that's how their email would read. And then you get other ones that are like, "Mr. Drozd, we would very much appreciate your time if you could such and such and such." You know, very different attitude. This reminds me also, I can make an analogy of my classroom environments. In some of my classrooms, I'm called Mr. Drozd. In some of them, I'm called Jersey. And in some of them, and these are the ones, I hate this title, Mr. Jersey. Oh, God, I hate that one. That's like a trend right now in some classroom environments where they call you Ms. whatever your first name is. And it bothers me so much. It feels so diminutive. You know, it's like Mr. Drozd is too stuffy. Jersey is a little too personal, but Mr. Jersey is like this perfect fusion of fake respect and inappropriate level of comfort. On a personal level between teacher and student. But anyway, that's just my opinion. but in all those different rooms, the dynamic between me and the students was very, very different, right? When Mr. Drozd said, "Okay, hey, if everybody would turn their attention to this," all heads turn. But when Jersey says, "Hey, can everybody turn their attention to this?" Like, there's that 3% they're talking amongst themselves. I'm like, "Hey, come on, guys, I got something cool to show you," you know? But in the Mr. Jersey classrooms, I will admit that there was like this high degree of openness and respect for one another, but also respect for each other's spaces. And like, kids could talk amongst themselves, but when I said, "Hey, look at the thing," they would finish their conversation, then look at the thing. So anyway, but where I'm going with this is that like, when it came to negotiating things, it helped if I started speaking the native tongue. Right. So like in the case of this one client who was like, "Hey dude, could you make this happen? Radical, wowie zowie," and whatever. I would say, "Hey, dude," and then I would say, "You know what would be really rocking is if we did this really bodacious, radical, awesome thing here." You know,
"Hey, dude, I would like to serve up your groovy design."
That's what it's like when I talk like that.
Cool, Pat.
I turn into Willy from Alf.
Oh, Alf, don't do that, Alf.
But anyway, you know, it helps if you start to speak their language, because it sets them at ease. You know, you're talking like how they talk. It's a dumb thing, but it's a little psychology thing. And it's not like you're manipulating them, but you're, you know, instead of, if I go at that, like my first impulse when somebody starts coming at me like, hey, dude, bodacious radical, I do stiffen up a little bit. I'm like, oh, okay, well, we're going to try to talk like human beings for a second here instead of like 13-year-olds when I'm in a client negotiations meeting. I noticed that when I relaxed out and stepped back from that defensive posture and kind of started speaking their language, then it was easier to make them understand my point of view or what I was trying to bring to the thing. It's a dumb little tip, but, you know, psychology counts.
It does. Yeah, it really does. It's a good exercise to get in and understand who you're serving. Your design's going to be informed in some way that it's I think of this as it's going native versus being imperial about things, right?
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. That's a very nice way of putting it.
Yeah, where you can go in and you know, use the client. Well, you have to learn, well, what are they valuing? How did this get to where it is? Whatever, depending on the kind of design and complexity. If they're just bringing you in for an afternoon to help with, you know, something really quick, mm-hmm. right? And that's different than if it's a, you know, like an 18-month project,
right?
And you definitely have a far more a far longer and more involved process of going native than you would in an afternoon. And then of course, you know, working out, well, what kind of ceremony, how native are you going to go? Right. Is it, yeah, I don't know. Cause some places I would, you know, go native as far as understanding the business rules and applications and all that kind of stuff and like, cultural things, but then not quite going to the same, you know, dress code or whatever. Right. So if they're extra casual, I like coming in as a consultant guy with the, you know, little bit sharper dress, you know?
Yeah.
Because I got the long hair to do the, you know, yeah, I'm creative guy, whatever. So, I like, anyway, whatever.
Sweater vest.
Yeah, exactly. Sweater vest and cummerbund.
Cummerbund? Cane. Spats. Okay, but what is there a closing statement? Is there a bow to put this on this for the person who's like, but I don't work for clients. I'm just thinking about design in terms of my own personal projects. What?
Oh, personal projects.
Why are you so mad about design? What difference does it make? I just got a WordPress and Comic Press installation. I'll just change this to red, and it works. It updates. It's functional. There's a forward and backward button. I don't need to do anything more with that. Shut up, professor.
Fair enough. I would say if you feel no pain regarding this, then rock on, dude. But
see, you're making fun now because you can say rock on, dude, and it feels natural coming out of your mouth.
I know. I'm having fun. So, but I would say that, you know what? Try to add a couple of things to measure over time. Your web traffic, certain things, are people commenting on them and interacting with you in ways that you're asking them to, right? And if those things are or aren't happening, that could inform you how your design is meeting them. Maybe if no one's doing a deep archive dive of your comic and you've got like, you know, 100 or so out there, maybe your archive is hard to find, or is, you know, there's something about it, right? And that can cause a design question for you to respond to.
Well, an example of how it could go is like, let's say your archive page is just a list archive. Here's my comics archives. Here's the November 1st post, October 22nd post, January 15th post. Well, that doesn't invite me to click. Oh, well, now I switch it to a thumbnail view. Here's a thumbnail of the comic. Well, a little bit better. Now it's or it goes to full archives. Now it's just like the full post. And now you just scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll and just keep digging back. Or it's a thumbnail with a description. In this episode, Thirsty finds out that his feet are made of sandwiches. Oh, wow. What's that all about? I'm going to click that. You know, So there's, you can play back and forth with that, and you just using the defaults, while that can be functional, you know, it wouldn't hurt to. Well, you mentioned off mic, we were talking about Krishna Sanasivam's PCweenies.com is a great site to watch because he is always tweaking the design. It's always like every other week it looks different somehow. And you know, this guy's just monkeying with it constantly. So you're going to it now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been meaning to figure out just from casual observation if he has a schedule because, yeah, he's constantly honing that site.
You get to talk to him on the Polytechnicast?
It's somewhere. What's that?
You get to talk to him on the Polytechnicast?
Yeah, he is on my list, actually.
Okay.
But I don't know. I haven't invited him and he hasn't accepted. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe Mr. Krishna is a little busy.
Well, he is on vacation right now, but.
No, I also more joking around, looping back to our conversation. I called him Mr. Krishna.
Oh, Mr. Krishna. I would call him Mr. Sadasivam myself. Mr. Rob.
Yeah. Gosh, the other one I think is really good that I do not have a conversational relationship with the gentleman, but John Rosenberg's Scene from a Multiverse.
Yeah.
Jonathan Rosenberg. It's a really funny comic and he's a really funny dude, but like his UI is, it's like quintessential what I think a storyteller can express an interactive presence for his or her comic in a way that that reinforces their voice and that isn't just like incidental, like it came with the frame style, like whatever.
Yeah.
The defaults don't hurt me, so let's rock. It's really good. Two of the ones I think are just really quite incredible are both Krishna Sadasivam's PC Weenies and Scenes from a Multiverse. And this one doesn't evolve that much. Like that's what I'm so curious about. Talking with him at some point is obviously this. Scenes from a Multiverse is a very specific visual layout that was probably, you know, all the iterations happened ahead of time. Some projects, that's how it goes. The design is very front end. Design effort is very front end focused before the project, you know, gets released. Whereas, you know, others, it's far more iterative. PC Weenies, like I said, I mean, it's monthly. It's at least every 90 days. When Krishna does like significant revisions to this thing.
And he works a full-time job and he updates the comic on a regular basis, not on a regular schedule, but on a regular basis. So, I mean, this is a guy who's putting a lot of attention into what he's doing. And that is something that I think in terms of ethos is something we really try to promote through our discussions is a sense of attentiveness and intentionality. Even if it is heuristics, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so one thing I've been wrestling with, so heuristics is completely valid. Like there is a, what kind of science is that called? Oh man, now I'm gonna like all Wikipedia tangled here. Essentially you can do empirical. There's different kinds of empirical research and, there's some that have more rigor and some that have less. And essentially the kind of design that we talk about at Lean Into Art quite often is the, it's very, very iterative. It's intentional, creative. You come up with a theory, you put it out there and you see how it goes and then you keep revising it. And then through that, you end up developing what are probably your own custom heuristics for your creative process and everything. And I suppose, that's getting all meta, but then tying it to like, go ahead, Jersey. I don't want
to. No, please. You were on a roll there.
Well, tying it to a specific point with this, it's, I guess in true Lean Into Art podcast fashion, we don't have an answer, but like it lies somewhere with, understanding your audience and finding out what they need to respond to help you through those design conversations, because they value it enough to have you there. So hopefully you can then, you know, meet them the rest of the way where you figure out, well, what do they need and how do you present that to help them so they don't end up affecting choices that truly would be negative to the design.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you have to ask yourself, am I native enough? Maybe this is right. But if it's not, then
an idea,
hopefully,
an idea that's fairly new to me. Only recently started really wrestling with this. The idea of how much of your creation belongs to your fans. Really belongs to them. And this was kind of, this is something I've been wrestling with for probably about the better part of a year now. Maybe a little bit longer, is this idea of with fan fiction and, remixing and all the stuff, like go to Tumblr and look up Homestuck and look at all the fan created material for the Homestuck comic strip or comic. I don't even know what to call it. Homestuck is a very, very weird bird that I'm still trying to wrap my brain around. And it makes you wonder, like, okay, where's the line? Where's the line between what I own as the creator and what the fans own as the people who have supported and encouraged and endorsed and made this thing a possibility if it's at all successful? Yes. And this was exacerbated by the discussion on the Hypercritical podcast with John Siracusa, where he was talking about this whole Star Wars thing and Lucas redoing his stuff and not leaving the original as an available option. By removing that from the table, he says Syracuse's argument. I'm not making a value judgment or a call on which side of the line I fall on this because I don't know yet. But he said that the original version belongs to the culture now, and while the copyright holder can iterate on it and change it and expand it any way he wants. He has a responsibility to the culture, especially something that affected the culture to that magnitude, to leave the original in its untouched state. Which got me thinking, making me really wonder about this idea of like, okay, what's mine and what's theirs? And what you're talking about, letting the users give you feedback because they care enough to be there. And so you want to design it for them. You're providing a service. And it also just reminded me of this notion of, that experience is their experience, and you have a responsibility to a certain point, tailor it to their experience. And the balance that you have to find is, because like I could see somebody coming at this going like, but I'm the creator. This is my house. You don't come into my house and tell me where to put the pictures. You don't tell me what color to paint the walls. This is my house. And that's a choice you get to make. But you also have to consider that there are, if you're identifying who your users are, or if you have users or fans or whatever you want to call them who are interacting
readers,
with you, I guess the question that I'm throwing out that I don't know if there is any kind of concise answer to like close out with, I'll just close with the question is, who's responsible to what in this environment? Is it a situation where you are just there to provide the service to the users, and when the squeaky wheel needs a greasing, you grease it? Or do you say, hey, this is my house, don't monkey with it, I'm going to create my experience, and if you don't like it, there's a million other websites to go to, to heck with you. Or is it somewhere in between? I think all of these different options all have their own validity, depending on the temperament of the creator. It's just a matter of making that choice intentionally, yeah?
Yeah, I agree. I don't know if I don't have an answer. I don't want this to sound like I've got pick me. but it is something that I consider why, right? So why, how do things go the way they go when you're collaborating as a group or serving a client, and how and why, and especially if there's a lot of so why do we divide stuff into roles to in projects? Well, you don't have to worry about them as much, right? So if you're doing the whole thing, now you have to worry about doing less of a thing. And maybe the less of a thing is a portion that has a theme that's really suited to your given skills and talents and whatever that But at the same time, it does come back to some core catalyst, reason that it's there. And if it's about money and funding or whatever, this is a comment, it's a theory, but I think it has a lot to do with, like, you pointed out how some creators have a strong sense of control. And I really think it comes down to control. And how do you look at control? Is it cool to wake up every day and think that, well, the universe is the chaos and I will flow like the water I am through whatever crevice and whatever crack, and I will freeze and make space and I will carve the mountain to make what I feel needs to exist in this world. And some days I can freeze and crack stuff and other days I got to flow and whatever, but I'm just going to go with it. Or is it, I build the mountains there because I told it to get there in exactly the way, you know, I shape the lava that whatever based on, you know, my will, it's there. Just different ways of looking at control, you know, and you'll put it as a design out there and then you could be as native as possible and it's still out of your control when, you know, you involve other people and have the, an approval that isn't you involved. So I guess when you're a solo designer, you get to, you know, really enjoy that full cycle of control for better or for worse, because then you don't have the other people in there helping you, which, you know, can be pretty darn fun collaborating.
And we should also say that you're probably talking in, when you define these two extremes, in a general sense, right?
Yeah.
You take either extreme in a general sense. Like, I oscillate wildly between everybody should have a voice in this thing to, whoa, that was a catastrophe. I'm going to make sure that I have a high degree of control over this thing because I want to execute the vision and not to let it turn into a freaky party where everybody's worshiping the golden calf, you know? So,
Time is a factor too,
yes.
Right? It's not black and white where I occupy this thing and this thing always. You can instigate and step back and instigate and step back.
Yep.
Too. And yeah.
Did we get at this at all? Anywhere you wanted to go, Rob?
No, it was fun. It was fun to talk about. I feel a little better. Ah.
I feel like I bogarted a lot of that, and I don't know if I went in any of the territories that you wanted to go.
It was a good conversation. We brought up a bunch of different interesting themes, and to be honest, this is something that I'm chewing on. This is what I might, one podcast I may be doing next year, so we'll see. And I don't even know what the heck it's called, but it's about
design.
Yeah, it's about design, user-centric design, stuff like that. I don't know. And either that or I'll just be bugging you with more of these topics for leaning to our guest.
I like it.
I have no idea. But it is, if I feel great, but the well is still full.
Yeah. Well, it's a big topic, too. It's a huge topic. Yeah. And I have very limited experiences with it in the sense of I know how I think about it in terms of comics. I did do a lot of work in the graphic design field, but it was working for real estate magazines and newspapers where it was like, make it red. Okay, I'll make it red. So, you know.
You have a lot of experience. I mean, if you're going through the act of creating something for someone else, whether that's just between you and an audience or between you and someone that's employing you to then reach their audience, either way, you know, that's a lot of experience.
Maybe the next one we'll do on this topic, we'll have to do as a video one, because I've got some examples of instances where I was presented with a very specific look for something, and then through the editing process with the client, it looked totally different. And when I held up the original thing, they said, we want it to look like this, and held up the thing that looked so different, I realized that, oh, the thing they were responding to in the original one wasn't the look, it was the attitude. And they took me down a whole different direction. It preserved the attitude, but it looked so distinct. So it brings up a whole new question of understanding what the client's even trying to say, like translating their words, because they don't know how to identify it goes to this idea of, and this is, I'm borrowing a story from Mary Jo, my teaching friend, where you read a book and then you go see the movie and you say, that's not who I would have cast as that character. And then somebody asks, who would you cast? And like, I don't know, but not that guy, which goes to show that you have an image of what that person looked like when you're reading the book, but you don't, it's not in your front cortex. It's somewhere in the subconscious. It's there, but you can't articulate it because you can't even see it. So too is sometimes a client can know kind of what they want, but there's no way they can put that in words or even put that in a sketch for you. So you got to do some, you know, translating there. There's a whole other thing to go into
yes,
later.
That is a huge one. And that's another good one too. It's yes. As I said, the well is full. I mean, it's just, it's a big, big, big topic, but it was fun. I mean, whatever. So I guess we just invited you to the gym of talk and design, and you know, Jersey did some reps. I did some reps.
The idea of me doing reps is just so comical.
you were working out along with us. So.
If I was doing reps, I'd be like, ow, ow, why does it keep hurting? All right. So call it the gym of design? Because I'm calling this the gym, okay. The design gym.
Cool.
No, I don't know. but anyway, yeah, so this is where I should say, if you thought Rob's thoughts on this stuff were interesting and compelling as I did, then you should go to leanintoart.com/workshops and you can check out, you can just type in Rob Stenzinger into the search field and it'll pull up all the classes Rob's associated with, like storytelling to make your UI's design awesome. And then making video games from comics and turning jokes into comics. Did I get the title right? Turning jokes into comics,
laughing Yeti monkey spaghetti.
Yes, there we go. Where it's not just about like how to write funny comics. It's taking sort of comedy theory and applying it to comic storytelling. That's the part that's like really interesting about it. You know.
Thanks.
And then also the Creative Variety Pack, where it's 11 hours of content with me and Rob going into a wild variety of stuff. But I think it was all really, really good content. So.
Oh yeah, and it was fun to package it up as one thing. It's really good stuff. So
11 hours, you could kill a whole day on that thing.
Oh yeah, I know. And it's video too. I mean, it's, you get the, you know, audio and video. So yep. Obviously whatever works for you, you get a really long drive or if you, you know,
and it's not just video of our heads talking. This is video where there's a interactive whiteboard where we're doing a lot of drawing. And in one of them, if I remember right, one of the labs was the, it was the improv story building one where we built a story from scratch, I think, right? About like the mechanic kid.
It was character design based. It was creating a cast of characters.
That's what it was. Yeah. How to create a
really
cast.
Really fun exercise. And
that actually, one went really well. I was really happy.
I would love
it.
To work, build a story off of what came out of that workshop.
Well, we should open source it.
Yeah.
All right. So, yes, leanintoart.com/workshops. So, you know, until we get sponsors for this show to pay our bandwidth and hosting bills, we're going to have to keep pointing people at the Lean Into Art store. That'll be our sponsor. Our sponsor is the Lean Into Art store. Please go and support our efforts with this free podcast by indulging in some of the great things that we have there for you to check out. So,
yes, thank you.
Okay. So, hey, good conversation, Rob. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jersey.
And until next time, everybody, I've been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on the Twitters.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.